Our topic for today is going to be DNA. So just a bit of context, I'm sure that everyone here is familiar with the fact that DNA is the form in which genetic information is coded and transmitted. So in humans, we have 23 chromosomes, which are these large molecules of these complexes of DNA. We're not going to get into what the different chromosomes mean. We're just going to look at the structure of DNA itself. You may already be familiar with this famous double helix that DNA forms. So let's first look at chemically what DNA is, and then as much as I'm able to, we'll get into how does DNA function on a chemical level. In other words, how does it get replicated? So first, DNA itself, what does it stand for? Oh, come on, you all must know this. DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid. So as that name sounds like, ribo, this, there is ribose in it. It also is acidic because DNA is essentially a polymer that incorporates phosphoric acid. So let's look at the components of DNA first. You're probably familiar with the bases. Some of you might be able to quote even from your high school days, guanine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine. Of course, there's also RNA, which has a different base in it, uracil. We'll get to that in just a moment. These bases are heterocycles, which means they are rings that contain atoms besides carbon in the ring themselves. The bases are the derivatives of two commonly encountered heterocycles. I say they're common. We didn't actually discuss either of them before, but in heterocyclic chemistry, they're certainly well known. So this is the compound purine, and there's a smaller, almost, you could say, analog of it, that if you imagine just containing the left-hand ring of purine, that is pyrimidine, which is also kind of like a cousin to, not aniline, not pyrrole. Compound with just one nitrogen in it that's benzene-like. I'm suddenly blanking on the name. Pyridine. Pyrimidine is a nitrogenous analog of pyridine. Add just a couple of substituents to these molecules, and we get the different families of the nucleic bases. They're called bases because, as you can see, they do contain these nitrogen groups. We should hopefully be familiar from the amine chapter that nitrogens tend to be basic. Oops. Go back up and add a hydrogen to purine there. So add just a methyl group to purine, we get adenine. Change the functional group a little bit. Make an amide out of purine. And we get guanine. From the pyrimidine, similar operation. If we make effectively a urea derivative, we get cytosine. And from there, if we put yet another carbonyl on, Then we get thymine. These are the four bases that are contained in DNA, and they're often abbreviated. One-letter abbreviations, rather logical ones, A, G, C, T. There is the fifth base, which is uracil. If you notice, uracil is very similar to thymine, except that it contains one less methyl group. That one is only found in RNA. What is made of these bases? Well, they show up in what are known as nucleosides. So if you remember glucoside glucoside, that was making some kind of connection through the anomeric position of a sugar to some other kind of substituent. In this case, the nucleoside is a combination of one of these bases with a sugar, again, at just the anomeric position. Now, DNA being deoxyribonucleic acid. The deoxyribo refers to ribose, which, haven't done this in a while, let's draw a furanose form of ribose. So just as a reminder, what is the Fischer projection structure of ribose? Oh dear, would these be one of the small topics you're going to review for the final? Your sugars? Don't forget your allosalose, glucose, mannose, all those others, nor your ribose, arabinose, xylose, lysose. Ribose is right. If we were going to flip this into a furanose form, then not worrying about whether it's alpha, beta, we'll have the OH groups down, and then the CH2OH group in the back will be up. Two prime deoxyribose means leave out the oxygen. It's called the two prime position because technically the oxygen substituted at the two position itself. So two prime kind of acknowledges that, yeah, it's something that's attached to the two position. And so it'll look like this. So no stereocenter, no OH group whatsoever. Why is there a difference between these two for DNA versus RNA? Well, DNA is the master template of the genetic information. RNA is something that's generated, but on a more temporary basis, in order to either replicate DNA itself or to perform one of the actions of DNA, which is to take some of that genetic information and turn it into amino acids. The ribose is much more easily reacted because of the participation of that that hydroxy group on the 2 position. I forget the number, but it's some huge number of times difference in hydrolyzability, reactability, between ribose and deoxyribose. If DNA is supposed to be the template, you don't want your template to be able to fall apart. You don't want your genetic information, to fall apart. And so the more robust, the more tolerant deoxyribose is used for that. Since RNA is used just on a temporary basis, and it's replicated and destroyed, it doesn't matter so much whether it is as stable for as long, nor do you need to then have to expend the energy to make something that would be more stable and then would require a little extra push to break apart. That's why ribose ends up being used in RNA, again, because it's just formed on a temporary basis. So if we take one of the bases and stick it onto one of the sugars, we get a nucleoside. So, for example, if we take adenine and combine it with ribose, then we get adenosine. So the ending changes a little bit to indicate that it has been stuck to a sugar. The nuclear base, that is. If you made the same thing, used the same base, but you used ribose instead, then it is 2' prime deoxy adenosine. Now to pause just again to give us a little context what we're building up to. You're probably already familiar that these 4 different bases are used to encode amino acid information. And it's going to be groups of 3 of these bases together will code one individual amino acid. We've now made the individual pieces that are going to go into this DNA strand. So each of these is one of the building blocks in making a DNA strand. How do we then link these different individual building blocks together? By making phosphate esters. Which I know that back last quarter even, I think we talked about what the definition of an ester is. So here's hydrogen phosphate. It's been monodeprotonated. React it with 2, I'll call them alcohols just for the moment. Notice that we could make what looks like an ester, other than the fact that we have phosphorus there, and we can make it in two different directions. So this is a phosphate diester. Now, I might have mentioned this in passing when we did go over our terpenes and lipids, but if you turn to chapter 26 of your text, so DNA's chapter 28, 27 was the lipids and terpenes, 26 gets into a little bit of metabolic pathways, chemically what's going on at a biological level, and it discusses phosphate groups and how they're involved in biological redox reactions. Not going to try to cover that here, but if you want to read more about the role of phosphate, chapters 26 is where I can direct you. So let's say that we took two different nucleosides, or actually before we take two different ones, if we take a nucleoside, we combine it with a phosphate, then we get a nucleotide. So it's a phosphate combined with a sugar combined with one of our bases. So let's take that same adenine. I'll combine it with deoxyribose. And on the back carbon, the one that is not itself a stereocenter, that's where we're going to attach the phosphate group. Which these have abbreviations as well. So, again, although I'm not going to get into detail about the phosphates, just to let you know that phosphate easily forms a phosphorus anhydride. You can stick two phosphoruses together to get an ion known as pyrophosphate. You can stick three of them together to get triphosphate. So what I've shown you here is deoxy, adenosine monophosphate. So full name 2' deoxy adenosine. 5', which again means it's not something attached to the 5 position itself, it's attached to the oxygen at the 5 position. 5' monophosphate. The mono refers to the fact there's only one phosphorus involved, that it's not one of these phosphorus anhydrides. Now, if you look at these abbreviations, some of you might be familiar with the molecule ATP. It's a close relative. ATP, without the little D beforehand, little D refers to deoxyribose. If you don't have the D, that means it's stuck on normal ribose. So if you have adenine stuck onto ribose and you have the triphosphate, that's the molecule ATP, which is involved in a lot of these biological redox reactions. Now that we have the nucleotide, now we can put it together into DNA strands. So allow me a moment to draw out the structure of a small segment of DNA. So first I'm going to draw the base thigh meat. And since we're talking about DNA, I'm going to stick it onto deoxyribose. Since this is a nucleotide, we'll have a phosphate at the end, which I'll come back to momentarily. So again, this is thymine. And I'm going to now draw adenine again. And there's a reason I'm drawing it the way that I am. Now, of course, it is also stuck to a sugar. Which means it's also stuck onto its own phosphate. Now, before I complete the structure, because I've actually left one substituent off the phosphate, let me show you why it is that the thymine and the adenine I've drawn this way. It's because they have the exact correct complementary structure, that there's the perfect distance and orientation for these two to have hydrogen bonding with each other. This is one of the critical and really sophisticated aspects of what DNA is. But since you already know, most of you, that DNA is this double helix, well, what's in this double helix? Well, it's two strands of DNA that are complements to each other. On one strand of DNA, for example, if you had the thymine, automatically on the other one, you're going to have adenine. If you have cytosine on one, then you'll automatically have guanine on the other. So there's this relationship, thymine with adenine, guanine to cytosine, or vice versa. If you have the original, or one strand has adenine, the other one's going to have thymine. So whichever one has one, the other strand has the other. This is because these two pairings of adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, again, have this exactly perfect hydrogen bond between them, which is what keeps the two chains locked together. Otherwise, the chains are separable, which is why DNA is able to be replicated. But now let me finish off this chain, because what do we have next? Well, the other side of the phosphate will link to the next sugar unit. Which will have another base hanging off of it, which is then linked to another phosphate, linked to another sugar, that again has a base off of it. So DNA is a polymer, meaning multiple repeating units, of phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. On every sugar, then, you have one of these bases. Between the two strands of DNA, you have complementary base pairs. Now, just for completeness sake, let me draw up the interaction between cytosine and guanine. The S stands for sugar. And here are our hydrogen bonding interactions. So the cytosine is the one on the left, guanine on the right. Now let me just show you a picture from the text. This would be a lot less painful than trying to read whatever I might draw. Here is a picture of that double helix that's in the process of being replicated. So the double helix, as it's called, it's because it's got two strands, the two individual polymer strands that do wrap around with each other. I forget, without looking at another diagram, which one is called which, but there are two that are called grooves. You can see that there's a sort of tight relationship between these strands, and then a larger gap between the strands. One of them is called the major groove, one of those is called the minor groove. And it's just because of having the exact right shape that these automatically end up twisting as you go from one base pair to the next, to the next, to the next. And you can see that everywhere along the chain, again, wherever there's a thymine, there's adenine that's paired with it. Wherever there's a cytosine, there's a guanine that is paired with it. At some point, the chain starts to split. And then there's a process, which I'll go over in a moment, for creating a new DNA chain. So once the chain splits, both of them get replicated. You get two new sets of DNA, but each one of those sets has one of the original chains of DNA in it. Now, just one point here. There are apparently chemical reactions that can occur during this process that will cause thymine to turn into uracil, but there are also enzymes that will convert uracil back into thymine to correct what would be known as a transcription error. Now, since I mentioned this word transcription, again, let me just show you some pictures here of what goes on. In fact, there's a good summary picture later on in your chapter. So here's a strand of DNA that gets split apart, and then over there. And then there's sort of the initial copying of that chain. Now, if this is being used to create... I'm sorry, this is not transcription. That's the wrong picture. Here we go. Which actually, that doesn't show you much more than that other diagram did. Let me move on then. So instead of talking about description, let me flip back to this other diagram, which is translation. So transcription is where you're just making pieces of RNA from DNA. Translation is where you actually act on the encoded information to make proteins, to make amino acids. So let me explain that part now. That's what I was starting to show here. So when you first copy the DNA, you'll make an initial run of RNA that actually gets acted upon. You can see it's split off into different types of RNA. There's messenger RNA, there's ribosomal RNA, and then T is transcription. Or transfer RNA. Here's the way that transfer RNA works. At the bottom of the transfer RNA, which here's a picture of what that looks like. So you can see it's a shorter sequence of base pairs And in fact, they're not all base pairs. It's just a series of bases, at the bottom of which they have something called an anticodon. So codon is the word for three base sequence that is equivalent to a particular amino acid. So you have those along the RNA chain. You have a bunch of these types of molecules floating around in solution, which have the complementary codon called the anticodon that tries to line up with it. At the top of this molecule, which there's an example shown here at the bottom. Let's see if I can scroll this up. It's cut off just at the bottom of the page here. But what ends up happening is the amino acid that corresponds to the codon is attached at the very top of this molecule. So back to one of the diagrams I was showing you earlier. Once you pull the chain apart, you can see down at the very bottom here, you have the RNA chain that has that genetic information. You have these transfer RNA bits that line up and fit just exactly right the sequences of three bases. Once you have all the amino acids lined up then, there's an enzyme that can come together to make all the amide linkages that would create the protein. So DNA gets split up, turned into RNA. RNA gets split into different kinds of RNA. One of them, the transfer RNAs, which are like the assembly line, say, for making the protein. They all line up in the correct places along the proteins with the amino acids attached to them. As they line up, then the amino acids get linked one to another, to another, to another, and that's how a protein is generated.
Just to show you some example, or show you the table.
So codon, that word I used a minute ago, that does refer to a grouping of three of the
nuclear bases. And it turns out there's a set of, because if you have four for one of them, four for the next, four for the next, 64 different combinations.
Turns out some of these combinations are redundant. So you can see, in fact, just glancing at the table, there's a whole bunch of combinations that will end up generating the amino acid leucine. There are also three combinations that you can see here that code as stop, meaning it shows where, once you start making that protein, should that whole machinery stop and make the end of the protein.
Now, those of you who are interested, there is a section in the text which I don't remember seeing in previous texts, so I think this author must be someone who is much more of a biological bent. It actually gets into a PCR, which stands for polymerase chain reaction. It's a way of taking a single strand of DNA and within just a short time frame, getting it to split, fully replicate, split, replicate over and over again. In the space of an hour, it says, you could make over a billion different copies of that same original DNA. It also talks about making artificial DNA sequences. So much in the same way that we talked about amino acid synthesis and how there's a resin support, a solid support synthesis. Turns out there's a solid support synthesis for DNA as well. But that comprises my attempt at doing a very low-level review of the organic chemistry involved in DNA. Now, as far as what we'll do tomorrow, I've had enough people that have again requested it that, yes, we will have our small talk on neurotransmitters, which I know we already talked about neurotransmitters when we went over, which lab was it? I forget which lab it was we were covering. But I'm going to go over some of the different kinds of classes. Since tomorrow is also our last chance for meeting for the quarter,
And with the few minutes we have left remaining today, if you all have been studying for the final and you had a few minutes of questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them. Anybody got any kind of question content-wise for the final? So the main questions on mechanism and synthesis will be primarily carboxylic acids. Don't forget that there are two mechanisms from the amine chapter, the Curtius and the Hoffman rearrangement, that you never had on any kind of question. So you're almost guaranteed to have those show up on the final. Yeah. Well, I test you on what? pH? No, so there won't be any of the ice problems. Really, a lot of that was just for review. If I was going to ask something that might be pH related, I might bring up the question of pH versus PI again, since there were a number of people that confused what the importance of the pH being below the PI or above the PI is. Other questions? The Fischer projections, what about them? Oh, the proof you mean? Ah, yes, because you never really got asked any of the tougher questions about the Fischer proof. Since you now have exam 2 back, you can refer back and see that I did ask about the Kilioni Fischer chain synthesis. I talked about ozosomes. And so we had this idea that there's a structural relationship between arabinose, glucose, and mannose. But we never discussed about what the significance of arabinaric acid being optically active is, or the fact that glucose and mannose both make optically active acids. We never had a question on that. So I would be prepared. Given the time I have on the final, you probably won't have more than one question about it. So maybe only one portion of the proof. But in other words, I'm not telling you ahead of time which one. Any other questions? Yes. The what? I'm sorry. Naming. Oh, yes. That's something everybody's been worrying about. The one thing that we named more than once was esters. So out of all the carboxylic acid derivatives that you would need to know how to name, either just a carboxylic acid itself, which is easy. You take whatever base name that is, whatever core name you have, so like hexane, and you add oic acid, so hexanoic acid. That we'd already done. Instead of oic, we add O8 if you have an ester. So 6-carbon carboxylic acid with 4-carbon alcohol would be butyl hexanoate. Those would be really the only two forms of naming other than whatever amines I gave you common names of or whatever sugars, amino acids I gave you common names of. Last chance for questions. Then I guess we'll end just a tad early today.